Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, January 4th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, Building Owner Plans Partial Demolition. City official says owner of Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building now intends to demolish its southern section. It's written by John Cruz of the Telegraph Herald. After months of attempts to stabilize the deteriorating Dubuque building, its owner is now pushing for a partial demolition of the structure. On Wednesday, Dubuque Assistant Housing and Community Development Director Mike Belmont informed the Dubuque City Council he had received an email earlier that day from Steve Emerson, the owner of the Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building at 3000 Jackson Street, who said he plans to move forward with demolishing the southern section of the structure. Belmont stressed that an official demolition request had not yet been submitted to the city, and Emerson did not attend the city council meeting on Wednesday night to provide further details. Dubuque City Council members said they would support the move to partially demolish the structure if it quickened the reopening of a portion of Jackson Street adjacent to the structure that has been closed since August. I think we've basically stated that while this is an unfortunate outcome, it is a very potential outcome, said Mayor Brad Kavanaugh. I do look forward to moving more quickly. In June, structural issues with the building prompted the city to give Emerson 180 days to resolve the problems, a deadline that expired the first week of December. An analysis of the structure in August determined it to be a significant danger to the public, prompting the closure of Jackson Street from East 29th to East 32nd Street. Crews with D.W. Zinser Company, the company Emerson hired to complete the work, began stabilization efforts on the building in October, which were to include removing portions of the structure's south-facing wall, completing wall stabilization work, and removing the building's towers temporarily. However, the work was soon halted over concerns that the continued removing of materials would create further destabilization. Since then, the city has pressed Emerson and his hired engineers to submit a plan for a bracing system that would ensure the building would remain safe when stabilization work is restarted. But the submittal of those plans continued to be pushed back by Emerson throughout December. As of Wednesday, those final plans were never submitted to the city. The proposed demolition would consist of all sections of the building that lie south of the archway entrance located on Jackson Street. If completed, the demolition work would resolve the safety concerns that prompted the city to close the section of Jackson Street, Belmont said. He said it would likely be another 2 weeks before demolition work can begin, and the demolition itself would require the street to remain closed for some time. Dubuque City Manager Mike Van Milligan said he had received an email from Emerson that indicated the developer planned to ask the city for $500,000 to assist in funding the building demolition, a proposal Van Milligan made clear he does not support. I wouldn't recommend that we provide him with the money to tear the building down, Van Milligan said. Emerson had previously told the Telegraph Herald that he was considering partially demolishing the building, while also stressing that he would still plan to redevelop the remainder of the structure and apply for state tax credits in April to help finance the project. City Council members asked city staff to keep them informed on the progress of the demolition of the building and urged city staff to continue pushing Emerson to resolve the deteriorating condition of the building one way or another. I do think that we as a city are pushing and doing as much as we can to resolve this problem, Kavanaugh said. I guess we continue to ask for the patience of our residents who live in that area. Our next article is written by Benjamin Fisher, and it's entitled, County Officials Hope to Avoid Higher Tax Revenue Restriction. Dubuque County estimates a 5.95% increase in taxable property value, just below a second state threshold on growth. Dubuque County officials believe they may have avoided a worst-case scenario regarding a tax revenue growth, but official numbers from the state to confirm that belief have yet to be provided. Dubuque County Auditor's Office estimates a total of 5.95% increase in taxable property value in the county, which includes higher-than-expected commercial property assessments. The total taxable valuation estimated by Dubuque County on Wednesday blew past a 3% growth limit placed on counties by the Iowa legislature last year. Per the law, any county that exceeds a 3% increase in taxable value is subject to a 2% reduction in its taxing authority. If Dubuque County's numbers are confirmed by the state, county taxable valuations would increase from the current fiscal years by 3.95% in a time when operating costs for county governments have risen at a substantially higher rate than that estimated growth. County officials in eastern Iowa waited throughout the day Wednesday for Iowa state agencies to release official numbers on those valuations, which could be slightly different than county's estimates. But the state numbers never came. Dubuque County's estimated 5.95% valuation increase is near enough to the 2023 reform's second growth limit of 6%, which would reduce the county's revenue growth by 3% to offer little immediate relief to worried officials. "We could make it out better than we thought, but just," said Dubuque County Auditor Kevin Dragato. Counties were still waiting for official numbers from the Iowa Department of Management as of Wednesday afternoon. "Every hour or two, I look again," said Jackson County's Deputy Auditor Shelley Hoy. "So we're still having to wait. Counties need to know their valuation numbers before county officials can begin building their budgets for the fiscal year beginning July 1. Budgets are due to the state by mid-April." Hoy told the Telegraph Herald that urban valuations in Jackson County were up around 6%, so they too are anxiously watching for official numbers. Dubuque County's increase in taxable property valuations from the current fiscal year, based on the estimated 5.95% increase, would be $314.6 million, according to county numbers. Property tax exemptions, which were also greatly expanded in the 2023 reform, would increase by $28.3 million. Expanded exemptions included those for veterans and Iowans 65 and older. Also, property valuations subject to tax increment financing would rise by another $217 million, a 33.75% increase according to county numbers. Property values as assessed in 2022 were way up over 2021 levels in nearly every category, but it was commercial property's 24.4% increase, the category that Dubuque County had been waiting for since most residential and agricultural property was roughly figured last November, that drove much of Dubuque County's growth. Agricultural dwelling assessments rose by 17.42%, industrial increased by 6.41%, and residential rose by 6.06%. Dragato said the increased valuations were driven significantly higher because the legislature included new construction in the reform, and given the substantial increase in commercial property development in Dubuque County, which now includes multi-residential properties, that meant a larger impact locally. Dragato has consistently been critical of that component of the new law, especially. "New construction's not subtracted from it," he said Wednesday. "You're disincentivizing growth at that point. Commercial property assessments and taxable valuations are also far more complicated than other properties," according to Dubuque County Assessor Billy Selby. "Under a lot of those subcategories, the first $150,000 of commercial property's assessed value is taxable at the same rate as residential," he said. "After that $150,000, it's at that 90% rate. Different portions of most of the different types of property, as designated in Iowa law, are allowed to be counted by different local taxing authorities at different rates. Then, as Dragato was quick to point out, it is actually the Iowa Department of Revenue that decides via a process called rollbacks what percent of the actual assessed values of different types of properties can be taxed in each category. For instance, the taxable value of agricultural land was given a 71.8370% rollback if it was in an incorporated city and 46.3428% if it was outside of cities. Those rollbacks led to a decrease in total taxable valuation of Dubuque County's agricultural land, which is separate from agricultural dwellings, of $3.85 million. Drogato said he did not know when to expect officials' numbers from the state government as of Wednesday. And in the final article from the front page of the Telegraph Herald this morning, former Dyersville mayor touted city's great potential. Jim Heavens dies at age 72 after serving the community and bringing joy to the people around him. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey. The dateline is Dyersville, Iowa. From the moment he moved to Dyersville almost 30 years ago, it would have been hard to find a more ardent supporter of the small town than Jim Heavens. Jim believed with his whole heart and soul that this community had great potential, said Dyersville Economic Development Corporation Executive Director Jacques Ray. He often said about Dyersville, "We are favored and blessed." He truly believed that there was something unique here, and he was honored to be a part of it and entrusted with making decisions for the community. Heavens, who served for 14 years as Dyersville's mayor, died on Thursday, December the 28th. He was age 72. Born June 16, 1951, he grew up in Coal City, Illinois. In 1973, he earned a bachelor's degree in agriculture from the University of Illinois, where he later would earn both master's and doctoral degrees. After college, Jim took a job as an animal nutritionist at Hubbard Feeds in Mankato, Minnesota, where he met his wife, Kathy. The two tied the knot in 1983 and welcomed three sons over the next several years, Alan, John, and Patrick. He always liked to joke that we were the first family ever created because of the first day God created the heavens and the earth, said Alan Heavens. In 1990, Jim accepted a job with Super Sweet Feeds, and the family moved to Charles City. 5 years later, he was hired by U.S. Feeds and was told he could choose whether to relocate to Dyersville or Eldora. Intending to research both locations, Jim set out to visit Dyersville. A devout Catholic, he sought out the priest at the Basilica of St. Francis Xavier, who sang Dyersville's praises and confirmed Jim's belief that the city should be the Heavens' new home. He didn't even do any research into Eldora, Alan said. As soon as he got to know Dyersville, he fell in love with it right away and said, "There's no need to look at the other option because nothing could beat this." Jim quickly got involved in the community and nurtured a lifelong love of politics by running for mayor in 2003. To his own slight surprise, considering he had been a Dyersville resident for less than 10 years at the time, he won. Over the following decades, he was reelected six times over two separate spans and served until 2021 when he opted not to run again and was succeeded by Jeff Jacques. Ray described him as a collaborative, forward-thinking leader who always supported the local business community and was particularly instrumental in the growth of the city's 20 West Industrial Park. Jim's time in office also included various discussions about the Field of Dreams movie site. In 2011, Michael and Denise Stillman purchased the property and announced plans the following year for 24 new ball fields, an indoor training facility, team dorms, and an amphitheater. The plans did not come to fruition before Denise Stillman's death in 2018, but Jim understood what that could do for our community, Ray said, and no one was more thrilled than Jim when he was able to work with Major League Baseball for the first of two games played at the field in 2021 and 2022. Go the Distance Baseball, which owns the Field of Dreams, is currently working on Project Heaven, an $80 million development that will include a recreational youth sports complex, boutique hotel, RV park, and outdoor amphitheater at the site. I'm glad Jim got to see some of the fruits of his early labors start coming to fruition in that being built and the MLB games being played here, Ray said. Jim also pursued elected state offices, running for state treasurer in 2010 and seeking an Iowa Senate seat in 2014. Neither bid was successful, but he considered both a positive experience and valued the relationships he formed during the campaigns, according to Allen. In 2021, Jim felt it was time to step back as Dyersville's mayor and encouraged Jacques to run for the position. I cherished his friendship and respected his opinion, Jacques said. He was a guiding light for so many years, and the community owes so much to him for the progress that we made. We're at where we are because of his leadership. Outside of work, Jim cherished his time with family, whether that involved touring Europe with Kathy or making sure he talked to every single person at each family reunion. Throughout his whole life, he loved people, Alan said. He loved meeting people and knowing about their lives, and I think the most joy he got in life was bringing joy to other people. No problem was ever too big or too small for him to go tackle it on someone else's behalf. After leaving U.S. Feeds, Jim launched several of his own businesses, always in the area of animal health and selling feed. He was on the road December 28, 2023, heading home after making deliveries to customers when he experienced a heart attack and his vehicle drifted off the road, according to Alan. Some years ago, Alan said, he asked his father how he would want to be remembered. He doesn't remember how the topic came up in conversation, but he does remember Jim's answers. What he said was, "I hope people will say, I'm glad I knew him," Alan said. That was pretty much it, and he was not known for being brief. He could be long-winded when he got talking, but that time, that was how he summed it up. Ray has no doubt that Jim will get his wish. "I know he will be remembered as someone who truly loved his community," she said. Now we've come to an article entitled "Critics of Proposals to Consolidate Iowa's Boards, Commissions Gather in Dubuque." Residents share concerns about the state's possible elimination of more than 100 citizen advisory groups. This is written by Benjamin Fisher of the Telegraph Herald. A diverse group of more than 50 people gathered at a Dubuque listening session to share their opinions, most negative, about a proposal to eliminate or consolidate many of the state's citizen advisory boards and commissions. The proposal came from a board created during last year's Iowa legislative session to convene and consider the list of the state's 256 boards and commissions which advise state government officials on a wide variety of interests. The new board recommended eliminating 111 of the boards or commissions and consolidating 50 others. It also recommends changing many of the rules by which those boards and commissions meet. At a meeting held by Iowa Representatives Chuck Eisenhart and Lindsey James, Democrats from Dubuque, Wednesday night, many past and present members of boards spoke out against the proposal. "We believe that physician assistants best regulate physician assistants," said Natalie Weber, a Dubuque physician assistant and member of the board that grants licenses for that profession. "Historically, we were a subcommittee under the Board of Medicine, as recommended again. There was a lot of inefficiency, a lot of things that slowed down PA licensing." Brian King, a member of the Iowa State Board of Education, stepped forward with a massive stack of state education regulations he had recently helped review as a member of the current 11-member board. King opposes the recommendation that the board be cut to 7 members. "There's a little trepidation out there about how much more a group of people can do who meet 11 times a year for a day or two," he said. "But I do think there are some good things about streamlining and editing and making rules more efficient." A court reporter, a podiatrist, and a longtime Jackson County supervisor added their voices to criticizing the proposal. Eisenhart and many attendees said the recommendation blocked civic engagement. "If the board doesn't exist, then the average person's ability to make a comment and get their perspective on the radar of people helping make decisions disappears entirely," he said. "But area Republican lawmakers support the effort, if not all of the proposals themselves." Iowa Senator Dan Zumbach, a Republican from Ryan, told a crowd at a Dyersville area Chamber of Commerce forum recently that Iowa had more boards and commissions than other states and that pruning them would save state funding. "When you look at the state of Iowa, we were bloated with boards and commissions compared to other states our size and other states in our area," he said. Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren, a Republican from Piasta, told the Dyersville crowd that some boards had been superfluous, however good their intentions, referring specifically to the state's Air Service Retention Board for Iowa airports. I said, I want to be on that board. We need that, she said, referring to American Airlines' 2022 decision to cancel routes from Dubuque to Chicago O'Hare. But I found out that board had never even met. Why do we even assign a legislator to that board? Iowa Senator Kerry Colker, a Republican from Dyersville, recently told the Telegraph Herald in an interview that she expects Senate government committee members to spend much of their time this next session, which begins on January the 8th, on legislation responding to the board's and commission's recommendation. Now, here's a few short articles under the News in Brief heading. First, more than 6,700 pounds of ground beef recalled due to E. coli concerns. A Western Illinois meat processor is recalling nearly 7,000 pounds of raw ground beef sent to institutions and restaurants in Iowa and Illinois. Valley Meats of Coal Valley, Illinois is recalling approximately 6,768 pounds of the beef because of possible E. coli contamination, according to a press release issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service. The release states that the ground beef items were produced on December the 22nd and bear the establishment number EST5712 inside the USD mark of inspection. The beef was shipped to distributor locations in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and Michigan for further distribution to restaurants and other institutional users. The E. coli contamination was discovered via routine testing. There have been no confirmed reports of related illness, but federal regulators are concerned that the beef may be in institutional or restaurant refrigerators or freezers. Restaurants and institutions are urged not to serve the beef and instead discard it or return it to the place of purchase. Call 888-674-6854 for more information. And Dubuque to host Special Olympics Iowa Winter Games. More than 200 athletes will visit the Dubuque area next week for the 36th edition of the Special Olympics Iowa Winter Games. The two-day event will be held Monday and Tuesday, January 8th and 9th at Grand Harbor Resort, Sundown Mountain Resort, Camp Albrecht Acres, and Inn on Ice Arena, according to a press release. Organizers expect about 239 Special Olympic athletes and their unified partners to participate in alpine skiing, cross-country skiing, figure skating, speed skating, snowshoeing, and cornhole. Opening ceremonies will be held at 6 p.m. Monday in the Grand River Center. The ceremony includes a parade of athletes and the lighting of a flame. Preliminary competitions begin Monday, with time trials for snowshoeing beginning at 12:30 p.m. at Camp Albrecht Acres. Speed skating preliminaries begin at 1 p.m. Monday at I'm on Ice Arena, as well as the alpine and cross-country skiing assessments and time trials at Sundown Mountain. Competitions will continue until 3:30 p.m. Tuesday. And Dubuque Youth Organization to hold open house January 8th. A Dubuque organization for youth will hold an open house next week. Boys and Girls Club of Greater Dubuque will hold the event from 4:30 to 6 p.m. Monday, January the 8th at the club, 1299 Locust Street, according to a press release. The release states that the event will showcase increased efforts in science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics programming, including an enhanced art room complete with a kiln. The investments were boosted by a grant from DRA that also allowed the organization to hire an art teacher. The organization also completely renovated the club's technology room and began offering scholarships thanks to the recently established Meyer Family Scholarship. The scholarship supports youth attaining higher education. The open house event will include a complimentary hot chocolate bar and cookies. And here's a police report from the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff Departments. Aaron E. Rigby, age 46, of 200 Olympic Heights Road, was arrested at 1 a.m. Wednesday at a residence on a warrant charging third-degree harassment. Anthony D. Blackburn, age 53, of 1560 Iowa Street, number 4, was arrested at 6:01 p.m. Tuesday in the 2600 block of Rockdale Road on a warrant charging possession of methamphetamine with intent to deliver, and the theft of a trailer worth $4,800 was reported Friday in Dyersville, Iowa. Here's some developments from the Dubuque City Council. RFP approved for automated traffic enforcement system. City Council members voted 6-1 to approve a request for proposals for the creation of an automated traffic enforcement system in the city. Council member David Resnick cast the lone dissenting vote. In November, the City Council approved an ordinance allowing the city to implement automated speed cameras on its roadways, which will be able to automatically identify vehicles traveling over the speed limit and issue a civil citation pending review from a police officer. The city is now seeking a vendor that will install the cameras and set up the system used to maintain records and issue citations. The RFP states the city is also seeking a system that includes a private website on which police officers can review the photos and decide whether or not to issue citations to motorists identified by the cameras. Proposals from potential vendors are due by January 26th. The City Council is expected to vote on a recommended vendor March 4th. If approved, the City Council would still need to approve an official city policy regarding automated traffic enforcement before the camera system can be implemented. City leases portion of former Medline building for city offices. City Council members voted 7-0 to approve leasing property from Dubuque Child Care Collaborative LLC at the former Medline property, now the Learning Campus Condominiums. Dubuque Initiatives purchased the former Medline building at 7900 Chavanel Road, which will include a new child facility, an emergency communication center, preschool, and leasable office space. The city is leasing 7,225 square feet, which will be occupied by the city's Information Technology Department, Traffic Department, and Shared Data Center. The rented unit will cost the city $7,886 per month in rent and partial payment of maintenance, insurance, and taxes. The city intends to move its data center into the space before July 1 and relocate the IT and traffic departments shortly after. And city proposes using $3.2 million loan for sewer project. City Council members voted 7-0 to set a public hearing for a proposal to issue $3.2 million in state revolving fund sewer revenue fund loans for several sewer infrastructure projects. The funds will be used to pay for three sewer projects, the extension of sewer infrastructure to Tamarack Business Park and Crossroads Industrial Park, the connection of the city's sanitary sewer gravity system with the existing Twin Ridge Subdivision gravity sewer system, and the increasing of pumping capacity, installation of new control equipment, and other improvements at the Granger Creek Lift Station. The public hearing for the proposed projects will be held on January 16th. Now we'll turn to the opinions, and we've got an other view from Arthur Sire for the Telegraph Herald. Arthur Sire is author of After the Cold War. You can contact him at acyr@carthage.edu. And his article is entitled, Despite War and Hardship, Positive Signs Worldwide. Let a smile be your umbrella. A smile will always pay. That is from a tune which became very popular through a 1957 recording by singer Bing Crosby. Optimism is increasingly praiseworthy. Our television and radio media more and more focus on catastrophes of various kinds, earthquakes that are metaphorical as well as literal. This does not mean our world is become more dangerous or difficult or disaster prone. Rather, established media, along with many other areas of life, are being challenged and transformed. Disasters are not the real world in which the vast majority of the population lives and works. Describing significant positive developments and trends is helpful. First on the list, perhaps most important, the average human lifespan is increasing dramatically. This is particularly true in economically advanced nations. In industrial nations, the average human lifespan doubled in the 20th century. Stephen Moore and Julian Simon describe and analyze this in detail in the Cato Institute's It's Getting Better All the Time. Second, the vast mass of people in the world are no longer in abject poverty. As recently as 1980, approximately one half of the population on the planet lived in extreme poverty. The World Bank defines that condition as below $2.15 per day, valued in 2017 dollars, an estimate that takes account of drastically different cost and price structures in various countries and regions. Through the long sweep of human history, the overwhelming majority of people lived in destitution. Imminent death was a fact of life. That is no longer true. The COVID-19 pandemic distracted from, but did not seriously interrupt, this vast, increasingly universal trend. Predictions of negative economic consequences from lockdowns and other restrictions were wrong, though isolated children suffered. Our collective reactions to the COVID-19 pandemic indicate greater prosperity has brought much higher public health expectations. In 1968-1969, approximately 300,000 mostly young men rotating back home from military service in and around Vietnam introduced the Hong Kong flu to the United States. The contagion spread like wildfire. Unlike COVID, young people did not have relative immunity. President Lyndon Johnson spent time in the hospital, including intensive care. That pandemic did not become politicized. People then understood, realistically, that disease was unavoidably part of life. Most important, despite all the COVID-induced chaos, less than 10% of the world's population today is struggling because of living in abject poverty. Third, democracy is spreading. As recently as 4 decades ago, the people of Latin America lived almost uniformly in various degrees of authoritarian regime. Today, Cuba is the remaining extreme dictatorship in the Americas. Despite pervasive and ruthless state political control, the desperate need for foreign investment is forcing even Havana's geriatric communists to loosen their grip. Once tiny Costa Rica was a beacon of freedom south of our border, now that light spreads throughout the Americas. Even the autocrats currently in charge in Venezuela are obliged to face the people in referenda as well as elections. Likewise, genuinely representative governments are spreading in Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and other nations are overshadowed by disturbing news from China and North Korea. That is unfortunate. Democracy is spreading in Asia. Undeniably, free economies and representative democracies are interconnected. Adam Smith's classic, The Wealth of Nations, appeared in 1776, the year the American Revolution began. For Americans today, our greatest danger may be our own fears. Calm is required. Unfortunately, that is more easily preached than practiced. And here's a reminder that you are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we will turn to today's obituaries, and first we will remember Laura A. Sujak. Beloved wife, sister, daughter, and friend was unexpectedly called home on December the 30th, 2023. In celebration of Laura's life, family and friends may visit from 12 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, January the 6th, 2024 at Willow Funeral Home and Cremation Care, 1415 West Algonquin Road, 1.5 mile east of Randall Road, Algonquin, Illinois, where there will be a blessing at 3 p.m. An additional celebration of life will be held in Dubuque, Iowa, at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to, in memory of Laura, to your local Humane Society. For additional info, go to www.willowfh.com or call 847-458-1700. Next, we remember Marcia McKenna, age 66, of rural Otter Creek, who passed away peacefully at home, surrounded by her loving family on January the 3rd, 2024, after a long battle with cancer. Private graveside services will be held at St. Lawrence Cemetery in Otter Creek. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, Dubuque, Iowa, is assisting the family. Next, we remember Nancy J. Woodrich, age 84 of Dubuque, who died Wednesday, January the 3rd, 2024. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon Friday, January 5th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where services will follow. Burial will take place in Linwood Cemetery. Now here's a listing of funeral services. Mary Lou Augustine, West Bend, Wisconsin. Visitation noon to 2 p.m. Friday, January 5th. Leonard Grau Funeral Home, Monona, Iowa. Service at 2 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. Sally A. Benke, Merrill, Wisconsin. Graveside service 10 a.m. Saturday, January the 13th, Prairie Cemetery, Fenimore. Patricia A. Byers, Dubuque. Visitation 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, January 6th, Faith Temple Church. Service 4 p.m. Saturday at the church. Virtus J. Klassen of Bellevue, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today and from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, January the 5th, Hockman Meyer Funeral Home, Bellevue. Service 11 a.m. Friday, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Bellevue. Shirley I. Dock of Dubuque. Celebration of Life 1 to 6 p.m. with the time of sharing from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, January the 20th at Happy's Place. John M. Denglinger of Dubuque, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, Holy Ghost Catholic Church. Dennis M. Dixon, Livingston, Wisconsin, visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today and from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Friday, January the 5th, Lancaster Youth and Ag Building, Celebration of Life, 11 a.m. Friday at the Youth and Ag Building. Robert H. Doring, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 6th, St. Clement Catholic Church, Lancaster. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Celester A. Feldman, Rickardsville, Iowa. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today, Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville, and from 9 to 10:15 a.m. Friday, January the 5th, St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church, Balltown. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Friday at the church. Norma J. Freese of Dubuque, Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. today, Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Janet E. Friedrich, Cassville, Wisconsin. Visitation 3 to 6 p.m. Friday, January the 5th, Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. Keeler Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Saturday, January 6th at the church. Anna M. Cabela, Platteville, Wisconsin. Visitation 12:30 to 1:30 p.m. today, Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville. Service 1:30 p.m. today at the funeral home. Dorothy L. Konicek, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 6th, Faith Community Church, Prairie du Chien. Service 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Diane K. Lahr, Worthington, Iowa. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, January the 9th at Rife Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, January the 10th, St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Lana L. McDermott, Galena, Illinois. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January the 5th, Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 6th, United Methodist Church, Galena. Service 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Darlene R. Rittenauer, Savannah, Illinois. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 6th, Law Jones Funeral Home in Savannah. Service 11 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Robert J. Steger, Dubuque. Graveside service 1 p.m. today, Dubuque Memorial Gardens. Celebration of Life 4 to 7 p.m. today, American Legion, 1306 Delhi Street. Richard Wachter, Asbury, Iowa. Visitation 9 to 10:15 a.m. Friday, January the 5th, Resurrection Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Friday at the church. Here's some brief news from the Tri-State page. Christmas tree disposal schedule set in Platteville, Dateline Platteville, Wisconsin. Platteville residents have multiple opportunities to dispose of their Christmas trees this month. Beginning Monday, January the 8th, residents can set their real Christmas trees on the curb for pickup each Monday through the end of the month. The trees will be collected and disposed of by the City of Platteville Street Department each week, weather permitting. All ornaments and lights must be removed from the trees before the department collects them. Any questions about the pickup schedule or route can be directed to the Public Works Department at area code 608-348-9741. Also, Platteville Student Group recognized for diversity efforts. A Platteville student group has been recognized by a national organization for its work in fostering diversity and inclusion. Platteville High School's Diverse Student Alliance recently received the Grants in Place Fellow Award from Rural Schools Collaborative, according to a district-issued press release. The Alliance received the honor for its Celebrating Rural Diversity, Place-Based Learning in the Driftless Region project, which challenges the notion that rural schools lack diversity. Also honored were teachers Emily Zachary and Jessica Broglie. Zachary oversees the Alliance, which was created in 2021 and engages in student-initiated educational campaigns and events focused on diversity and inclusion. Broglie recently joined the district as an emergent bilingual teacher. As part of the Rural Schools Collaborative Award, the district will receive $2,500 toward the Alliance's efforts. We believe this grant will allow us to show our commitment to celebrating the rich tapestry of our rural community, Zachary said in the district's release. We want to continue to empower students to champion diversity through education and fostering a deeper understanding and appreciation of our unique region. And from Des Moines, a group of Iowa progressives to hold rally at state capitol. A group of Iowa progressives will hold a rally this weekend at the Iowa Capitol. Participants will join hands around the rotunda inside the Capitol for 2 minutes of silence at noon on Saturday, January the 6th, during Hands Around the Capitol, 1007 East Grand Avenue, Des Moines, according to a press release. A co-organizer of the event, Becky Sisko of Dubuque, states in the release that the events will focus on forward-thinking policies that help regular citizens of Iowa. We'll read one more article before heading to the sports page. It's entitled, New Ultrasound Tool Could Help Alzheimer's Drugs Enter Brain Faster. Scientists are using new technology to create temporary openings in the blood-brain barrier. This comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. Scientists have found a way to help Alzheimer's drugs seep inside the brain faster by temporarily breaching its protective shield. The novel experiment was a first attempt in just 3 patients, but in spots in the brain where the new technology took aim, it enhanced removal of Alzheimer's trademark brain clogging plaque, researchers reported Wednesday. Our goal is to give patients a head start by boosting some new Alzheimer treatments that take a long time to work, said Dr. Ali Rezai of West Virginia University's Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute, who led the study. At issue is what's called the blood-brain barrier, a protective lining in blood vessels that prevents germs and other damaging substances from leaching into brain from the bloodstream. But it also can block drugs for Alzheimer's, tumors, and other neurological diseases, requiring higher doses for longer periods for enough to reach the target inside the brain. Now scientists are using a technology called focused ultrasound to jiggle temporary openings in that shield. They inject microscopic bubbles into the bloodstream. Next, they beam sound waves through a helmet-like device to a precise brain area. The pulses of energy vibrate the microbubbles, which loosen gaps in the barrier enough for medications to slip in. Prior small studies have found the technology can safely poke tiny holes that seal up in 48 hours. Now, Rezai's team has gone a step further, administering an Alzheimer's drug at the same time. Some new Alzheimer's drugs on the market or in the pipeline promise to modestly slow worsening of the mind-robbing disease. They're designed to clear away a sticky protein called beta amyloid that builds up in certain brain regions, but they require IV transfusions every few weeks for at least 18 months. Why not try to clear the plaques within a few months, Rezai said, his rationale for the proof-of-concept study. Now we'll turn to sports, and our first article is entitled, Simon Leads UD Past Wartburg. Cascade native scores career-high 24 points in ARC home victory. It's written by Danny Miller of the Telegraph Herald. A whirlwind cross-country Christmas slate may have spelled a slight post-holiday hangover, but as it has done all season, the University of Dubuque powered through. The Spartans overcame an inconsistent first-half shooting effort that saw an 11-point lead evaporate, but followed with a dominant second half in an 81-64 victory over Wartburg in an American Rivers Conference contest on Wednesday at Stoltz Sports Center. The return to conference action comes on the heels of a 10-day holiday stretch that saw the Spartans go a combined 4-0 in Honolulu's Hoops in Hawaii Classic and the Nicolet National Bank Holiday Tournament in De Pere, Wisconsin. At 12-0 and 4-0 in the ARC overall, the Spartans are off to the program's fourth-best start in history. The perfect mark caught the attention of the pollsters as UD debuted last week at number 24 in the latest D3Hoops.com rankings. It doesn't mean anything right now. We're only four games into our conference schedule, Sieverding said. It's obviously great recognition for our guys, the work they've put in and the kind of start they've had. Our guys have been really tight-knit, and they have a confidence about them, and it's great to have that seen on a national level. Spartans graduate student Brock Simon, a former Cascade standout, posted a career-high 24 points on 10 of 12 shooting. Simon's spark came at an ideal time, with reigning American Rivers Conference Player of the Week and leading scorer Jalen McCants relegated to the bench for much of the first half with foul trouble. Freshman Tatum Arguello partnered with Simon in carrying the brunt of the first half scoring, netting 12 of his 14 points in the opening 20 minutes. UD built a 28-17 lead with 8 minutes 11 seconds to go in the first half before falling ice cold from the floor. The Spartans were just 14 for 37 in the first half after making its first four attempts to open the game. Wartburg ran off an 11-0 run to briefly tie the game at 28. UD led 34-28 at the break. The first half woes dissipated quickly, however. The Spartans shot a blistering 18 for 29, including 8 for 17 from beyond the arc in a torrid second-half pace that put the game out of reach. Next is an article entitled, Finding Another Gear, Hempstead Sophomore Among Midwest League's Leading Scorers. This is written by Jim Leitner of the Telegraph Herald. Cody Sweeney witnessed firsthand this summer the kind of hard work and determination it takes to earn an opportunity to play in the United States Hockey League. The 5'11", 148-pound sophomore from Dubuque Hempstead trained in the off-season at I'm On Arena with a group of Dubuquers that included Fighting Saints forward Andrew King and Green Bay Gamblers forward Blake Betchen. He, too, would like to pursue that path. It's awesome that they're playing in the USHL, and it just shows that you can come from Dubuque and play at the next level if you work hard enough at it, said Sweeney, the Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week. It's important to have role models like them, especially for the younger guys in the organization. The cool thing about them is they're really good guys, and you can ask them anything. If you're doing something wrong, they'll show you how to do it the right way, which only helps you get better. This was probably the best summer I've ever had because I put on some weight and muscle. That's really helped my game. Sweeney ranks third on the Midwest High School Hockey League scoring chart with 17 goals and 37 points through 17 games for the Dubuque Saints, who are currently in position to make the 8-team postseason tournament. As a 5'5", 125-pound freshman a year ago, Sweeney ranked second in the state's junior varsity scoring race with 32 goals and 60 points in 32 games. He also contributed 15 goals and 26 points in 32 varsity games. Last year, you kind of saw glimpses of what he could become, Dubuque coach Tim King said. We used him on the power play a lot because of his scoring touch, and the game kind of slows down for you when you have that man advantage. But 5-on-5, he struggled a little bit because of his size. This year, he's gained a lot of size and muscle, which has really helped his skill set. Now, he has the physical attributes to go along with his hockey IQ, his shot, and his ability to make plays. He's not going to lose those puck battles in the corner. There's a 90% chance he's going to come out of it with the puck on his stick. Sweeney has taken his game to another level in the last few weeks. He has tallied 12 points in the last four games while skating on a line with Carter Kirkenbush and Kalen Mezerich. "I have to give them a lot of credit," Sweeney said. "We've been playing really well together. They've been finding me, and the puck has been going in the net. The team is having a really good year, and our goal is to make it down to state and go on a good run." Sweeney began playing the game at age 3. "I don't know what it was, but I just fell in love with the game," he said. "I love the competition. I just love the feeling of being on the ice, and I really want to see how far I can go with it." King believes Sweeney has the physical tools and, more importantly, the work ethic and drive to play at a higher level. That attitude led to Sweeney being named an alternate captain, a rarity for a sophomore. After a brief practice Monday morning, King gave the players the option of staying after to work on their games. Sweeney used the opportunity to practice one-timers with Kirkenbush and Bryce Betchen. "Cody takes the game seriously all the time," King said. "Not that he doesn't have fun at it. He just constantly wants to get better on and off the ice in any way he can. He's a leader in the locker room and on the ice because of that. You can count on him to be there early and stay after practice. And any time there's ice available or stick and puck sessions, he's there working on his game." In the local and area roundup, Pearson leads UW-Platteville. Logan Pearson scored 25 points, including a pair of free throws with 6 seconds remaining in regulation to lead the University of Wisconsin-Platteville to a 74-69 victory on Wednesday night at UW-Eau Claire. Pearson went 9-for-19 from the field, including 1-for-3 from behind the arc, made 6-of-7 free throw attempts, and grabbed a team-high 6 rebounds as the Pioneers improved to 9 wins and 2 losses in their Wisconsin Intercollegiate Athletic Conference opener. Max Love contributed 19 points, and Ben Probst scored 9 for Platteville. The Pioneers led by 8 points at the intermission after leading by 16 with 1:32 remaining in the half. Michael Casper led the Blue Golds with 21 points, while Carter Hushka added 16 and Carter Lichtson had 10. Clark 73, Grandview 71 at Des Moines. Anthony Eddy scored 20 points. Biggie Luster added 14. Dubuque senior grad Daquan Lewis chipped in 11. And Jake Lehman had 10 as the Pride held off a late Vikings rally to win the Heart of America Conference tilt. Markel Hood led Grandview with 21 points. The Pride improved to 4 wins and 9 losses overall, 2 wins and 7 losses in the league. Loris 89, Buena Vista 75 at Storm Lake, Iowa. Declan Klerlik scored 18 points, and Tyler Bass and Ollie Sabert chipped in 15 apiece as the Dewhawks improved to 11 wins and 1 loss and 3 wins and 1 loss in the American Rivers Conference. Loris also got 11 points from Jack Haynes and 10 apiece from Jackson Molstead and Jared Pearson. Bass and Pearson each grabbed 9 rebounds. Zane Newbaum led Buena Vista with 24 points. In women's college basketball, Clark 71, Grandview 69 at Des Moines. The defending NAIA national champions got 20 points from Cascade, Iowa native Nicole McDermott, 12 from Taylor Hasse, and 10 apiece from Izzy Peterson and Maya Mershman in the narrow Heart of America Conference win. The Vikings rallied in the fourth quarter, outscoring the Pride 25-18. Clark improved to 15 wins, 0 losses, 11 wins, and 0 losses in the Heart. Loris 97, Buena Vista 46 at Storm Lake, Iowa. Madison Haslow dropped 24 points. Silvana Scarsella added 20, and Platteville native Sammy Martin chipped in 13 as the Dewhawks rolled to 11-2 losses, 3-1 loss in the American Rivers Conference. 11 different players scored points for Loras, which bolted to a 58-25 halftime lead and outscored the Beavers 28-7 in the third quarter. Wartburg 53, Dubuque 50 at Dubuque. Megan Teal scored 10 points, but the Spartans dropped to 8-5 losses and 2-2 losses in the ARC with the loss. Jaden Murphy led the Knights with 14 points and 10 rebounds. And UW-Eau Claire 70, UW-Platteville 45 at Platteville, Wisconsin. Sarah Mueller scored 15 points and Fenimore, Wisconsin native Brindley Nelson added 11, but the Pioneers fell to 7-5 losses in their WIAC opener. And in women's college hockey, Northland 4, Dubuque 1 at Ashland, Wisconsin. Gracie Hall scored in the second period for the Spartans, who fell to 2-11 losses in their inaugural season. Savannah Weishick made 35 saves. And UNI earns win on the road. Bowen Bourne scored 21 points and Jacob Hudson added 19 as the University of Northern Iowa edged Missouri State 64-62 on Wednesday night in Springfield, Missouri. Dubuque Hempstead grad Michael Duax had 2 points and 2 rebounds for the Panthers. Cesar Edwards led Missouri State with 25 points. Alson Mason chipped in 12 points, and Nick Kramer had 10. Seton Hall, 61, number 23, Providence, 57, at Providence, Rhode Island. Dre Davis scored 17 points, and Kaderi Richmond added 16 points as Seton Hall upset Providence. And Miami, 95, number 16, Clemson, 82, at Coral Gables, Florida. Nigel Pack scored 20 of 25 points in the second half. Matthew Cleveland and Norchand O'Meara each added 23, and Miami improved to 9-0 at home. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, January 4th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavek. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.